So my subject is why independency. There is a handout. You should have one. Looking at the subject of church order, how we organize ourselves as churches, probably not the issue that's highest on our agendas. But I want to read from Acts chapter 6 as we start to demonstrate why I think it really is important. So it's a well-known passage at the beginning of Acts chapter 6, just the first seven verses. Luke writes, "Now in those days, when the number of the disciples was multiplying, there arose a complaint against the Hebrews by the Hellenists, because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution. Then the 12 summoned the multitude of the disciples and said, 'It is not desirable that we should leave the word of God and serve tables. Therefore, brethren, seek out from among you seven men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. But we will give ourselves continually to prayer and to the ministry of the word.' And the saying pleased the whole multitude, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and the Holy Spirit, and Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch, whom they set before the apostles, and when they had prayed, they laid hands on them. Then the word of God spread, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests were obedient to the faith." It's a very familiar passage. We turn to it often, perhaps when we're thinking about the appointment of deacons or the role of deacons in serving a local church. But do you notice verse 7 and the connection between the first six verses and verse 7? I think this is absolutely vital. "Then the word of God spread, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests were obedient to the faith." Luke seems to connect verse 7 with what has gone before, with the right ordering of the church. The order, the way we organize ourselves as churches has a direct impact, Luke seems to be saying, on the progress of the gospel. So church organization, church order is not just some kind of secondary matter that we can try to organize as we see fit. It has, I believe, direct impact on the health and the life and the success and fruitfulness of gospel ministry. Well, the title of my talk is Why Independency? We're here as the FIEC, Federation, is it Fellowship? Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. Independent. Why is it important? Why is it important that we are independent? What do we mean by that? And I want to answer that question historically, first of all. I want to look at the history of how independency developed very, very briefly and draw some lessons from that. And then I want to look at some biblical principles that underpin independency. And then I want to think about how that works out today in terms of application. There's no clock in this room, is there? So I keep an eye on the time. I'm going to talk for about 30 minutes. Then there'll be some time for questions and discussion, and then we'll have a few moments of prayer at the end. That's the plan. History then. I want to take you back to the reign of the first Queen Elizabeth, 1558 to 1603, so the second half of the 16th century. During the reign of Elizabeth, the only legal church was the Church of England. Everyone was supposed to attend the parish church on Sunday. There were some exceptions for foreign congregations, so there were congregations of Polish people and French and others that met in London and had special dispensation. But apart from that, you were supposed to be in the parish church every Sunday. It was not possible under the law to meet as a Baptist church or as a Congregational church or as a Presbyterian church. You had to be in the Church of England parish church. And most people were happy with that, at least up to a point. The Puritans who began to flourish during Elizabeth's reign and then through the 17th century, on the whole, believed in a national established church. On the whole, they were Church of England men. What they objected to very often were aspects of the liturgy of the Church of England. The Book of Common Prayer that Thomas Cranmer had introduced under Henry VIII and Edward VI had been amended a little bit and developed under Elizabeth. there were aspects of that liturgy that they strongly objected to. For example, they objected to making the sign of the cross on an infant when they baptized the infant. They objected to the use of rings at weddings. They objected to the assumption in the prayer book funeral service that the person who had died was necessarily a believer. They wanted to see more church discipline in the Lord's Supper. And they objected to the fact that the liturgy in the prayer book left insufficient time for preaching. So they had objections to the liturgy, but not to the concept of a national church. They were fine with that. They were Church of England men, on the whole. But as time went on, some became unhappy with that as well. The way it seems to have developed was this, that they were so unhappy with these aspects of the liturgy that they felt they couldn't live with it any longer. They wanted to run churches that were, in their view, biblical in every respect, and so they began to meet separately. This was illegal, but they did it nevertheless. They began to ordain their own pastors and other church officers, to administer baptism and the Lord's Supper, to exercise church discipline, to run independent local churches. They met secretly. If they were discovered, they risked imprisonment or possibly exile. On the 4th of March 1568, 77 people were arrested. They were meeting at a goldsmith's house near the Savoy in London for Christian worship, and they were arrested. Most of them were put in prison. Some of them died in prison. Some of them were released. Others went into exile. There's a man called Richard Fitz. His name's on the handout. He led a congregation in London. They met for worship Sunday by Sunday in the houses of members, different members' houses, to try to avoid detection. They met on Wednesdays for prayer and for the exercise of church discipline. They had their own ministers, they had deacons. They had separated, and this is important, I think, they had separated from the Church of England. They were meeting in this way because, as I say, they objected to aspects of the liturgy. They viewed Anglican worship, according to the Book of Common Prayer, as false worship, idolatry, essentially, because in their view, it still was too closely connected with Roman Catholic worship. That was their main reason for separating from the Church of England. Objection to aspects of the liturgy. It was a reactive thing, really. They were reacting, I suppose you could say, negatively to aspects of the liturgy, so started to meet independently. And as I reflected on this, I thought, well, that's probably my experience as well, personally. I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I grew up in a situation, though, where there was a lot of Anglican influence. Better say, I have many Anglican friends and I love Anglican people, many of them, but I grew up in an Anglican situation. And when I was converted at the age of about 17, I reacted against aspects of the Church of England, bishops and other things. And by default then, really by way of reaction, began to adopt a more independent evangelical approach to church government and so on. And I think many people perhaps today, we're part of an independent evangelical setup because we've reacted, we've disagreed with aspects of Anglicanism, perhaps of Presbyterianism, and here we are as independent evangelicals. That was the situation with this congregation of Richard Fitz in London and many others at the time. But as they began to think more about the issue, they began to work out on a more principled basis why it was positively right and biblical, in their view, to meet in this way as independents. Robert Brown, it's Brown with an E on the end, I think his name's probably on the handout, is key here. He thought through this much more carefully than many others did and wrote about the subject. He was a strange man, but he did write very, very helpfully, I think, on this subject. He saw that the issue, ultimately, was that of authority. On what authority, on what authoritative basis do we gather together as a congregation to worship God in Christ? And he saw, I think rightly from the scriptures, that authority comes directly from Christ. It doesn't come from the state or through the state. There's no need for a national church with the monarch as the supreme governor. The authority for the local congregation to meet comes directly from Christ. Building on that, he saw that the state, therefore, had no authority at all to tell the church how it should run itself, what it should teach, when it should meet, and so on and so forth. The state had no authority to compel people to come to church, as it sought to do under Elizabeth. The government of the church is in the hands of the church, and he cited Matthew 18 particularly, and Matthew 16 to back that up. Robert Brown, then, is really the first, at least in the English-speaking world, to enunciate clearly, the first since the early church, I should say, in the English-speaking world to enunciate clearly independent principles, not separating merely on grounds of objection to liturgy and so on, not separating by way of reaction, but positively because it seemed to be the biblical way for the church to meet. And that's really the root of independency in this country. Now, Robert Brown's ideas were taken up by others. He himself, for reasons that are not clear to me at least, I think he came under a lot of pressure from the authorities. He himself actually conformed and rejoined the Church of England and served out his later years ministering within the Church of England, which seems bizarre. As I said, he was a strange man. Move on to 1616. So that's all at the end of the 16th century. Move into the 17th century, 1616, in Southwark, in South London, what is now South London. A dozen or so believers met together to fast and to pray and to discuss how they should organize themselves into a church. Again, this is the issue, isn't it? We form a church. We form a local congregation. We plant a church. On what basis do we do this biblically? What's our authority for doing that? How do we do that? How do we constitute ourselves as a church? What's the difference between a group of Christians just meeting together to pray and share from the scriptures and a local congregation? Is there a difference? Some of our Australian friends would say there's no difference. They would say any group of Christians meeting together is a church. I'm not sure that that's true, personally. I don't think that's the biblical approach. What is it then that turns it into a church? That's what these people were grappling with, these Christians in Southwark in 1616. And the solution they came to was a covenantal one. They entered into a covenant with one another, among themselves, in order to form this congregation. The description goes like this. They stood in a circle holding hands, and each made a statement of their faith and repentance, and then they covenanted together to walk in all God's ways as he had revealed or should make known to them. And that was the beginning of the Congregational Church in Southwark, led by Henry Jacob, which became very significant for the Baptist movement that emerged from that church later in the century. So what we see then historically, end of the 16th, early 17th century, is this emergence of independent churches that understood themselves to be constituting themselves on the authority of Christ, directly, if you like, on this covenantal basis, on the basis that Christ is head of the church, not the monarch, and that the authority to form a church comes from him and not from or via the civil authorities. These churches, these congregational churches, were separate from one another. They were independent in that sense. And of course, that contrasts with Presbyterianism and Anglicanism. There is in independency no higher authority in church life than the local church. So no bishop could tell the local church how to conduct itself. Parliament could not do so. No presbytery or synod or General Assembly could instruct a local church what to do. The local church was self-governing and autonomous. And that form then of church, government, congregational church, Baptist church, multiplied through the 17th century in this country and was exported to the New World, to New England, during that time as well. And that was the case, even though it remained illegal to meet in that way. Up until the death of Charles I, at least, and then again from 1660, with the restoration of the monarchy, Charles II returning, up until the coming of William III in 1688, when the Toleration Act was passed, 1689, which allowed such churches to meet without fear of penalty. Just one other historical note, which is important, I think, and that's the fact that many of these churches, particularly the Baptist churches in the 17th century, met together in association. They formed associations, regional associations. They had a national assembly that met, I think, once a year generally. But really the life of these associations, or we might call them partnerships, was in the regions. There were associations of Baptist churches in the 17th century in the Midlands, in the Southwest, in Oxfordshire, based on Abingdon and elsewhere. And they would meet together through representatives regularly, and they would discuss questions of doctrine. Individual churches would come with their questions. What do we do about this? What do we believe on this? What does our confession teach on this? Because they would tended to be based on the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. And they would talk through questions of church life. What are we to do? How should we conduct our services of worship? How do we care for the poor? How do we pay our ministers? What do we do if we can't afford to pay our ministers? So they discussed matters of common concern. They sought to help one another in the work of the gospel. More wealthy churches provided support to smaller, poorer churches, supplying preachers, supplying financial help. There was provision for joint action to plant churches together in areas where there was need. And even disputes between churches, or even disputes within a particular church, could be brought before the association for investigation and report. And I think here they were very, very clever. I'm not sure this is something the FIEC would want to take on. But the way they handled it was this, because the association, of course, had no jurisdiction over the individual congregations. If a dispute came before the association couldn't tell the churches what to do. But under their constitution, they could investigate, they could talk to the people involved, and they could produce a report which they could publish and make available to all the churches, just giving their view of the matter, not telling them what to do. But it's a very interesting exercise, isn't it, really, of soft power. Not jurisdiction, not authority in the formal sense, but something that would perhaps help to resolve issues. It didn't help in the early 18th century when a huge controversy erupted over the singing of hymns, but that's another matter. So associations. Moving on to biblical principles then, I'm just keeping an eye on the time. I do want to emphasize what I've already said, that these early churches organized themselves ultimately on the basis of principle, not reaction, not pragmatism, but principle. And they would often cite Matthew 16, verse 18, where Christ says, "I will build my church. I will build my church." It's Christ's church. That's what they would emphasize. And the authority then for local congregations comes from Christ. I want to organize our thoughts here under four headings, which are on the handout. First heading, really, the heading here is really the keys of the kingdom, and this relates to what Christ says in Matthew 16. I'm not going to look at all those references that I've given you on the handout, but just give you the general principle. So Matthew 16, verse 18, the Lord says to Peter, "I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." However exactly you understand that verse 19, it seems pretty clear that when Christ speaks of the keys of the kingdom, he's talking about this issue of authority. He's giving authority to the church. I think you can demonstrate from other passages that the authority here is not being given to Peter individually, but to the apostles. Peter is representative of the apostles, and the apostles then as representative, really, of the churches as they continue down the generations. Christ gives authority then to the church. And on the understanding of these congregationalists that I've been talking about, The church means the congregation. There's a difference here from Presbyterianism. So the Presbyterian understanding of this concept of the keys of the kingdom would be, yes, Christ gives the keys, the authority to the church, but really that means the elders. So under a Presbyterian understanding, the elders would be seen as the representatives of the local congregations, or of the local congregation singular and also plural. And so really it's the elders who have all the authority that Christ is speaking of here when he talks about the keys of the kingdom. And that's why in a Presbyterian setup, I've never been in a Presbyterian church, but my understanding is that really all the crucial decisions are taken by the eldership and not, generally speaking, referred in any meaningful sense to the membership. If you've had Presbyterian experience and I'm wrong on that, please do correct me. But that's my understanding. The congregationalist understanding by contrast, is that the authority goes in a real sense to the congregation. And then, of course, you've got to decide, hopefully on biblical principles, as to exactly how that's going to work out as between the elders and the membership. So clearly, clearly in the New Testament, elders are in principle to lead. They must take daily, day-to-day decisions. They must act in a kind of executive capacity, if you like. They are to be submitted to, they are to teach, and so on. But also in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, we see clear involvement by the congregation, by what we might call the membership, in particular kinds of decisions. The election of church officers, deacons, and elders, and also in the discussion of vital questions of doctrine. I think you can see that in Acts chapter 15. Elders, yes, are to lead, they're to govern, to shepherd. The principle is that authority lies with the congregation as a whole, and certain of these really important matters for the life of the church rest with the church membership. It's not a democracy, it's a Christocracy. The idea is that through the membership of the church and under the leadership of the elders, the will of Christ for that local congregation emerges. That's the idea. It's not. I think it's very important when we seek to explain this to our congregations that we make clear it's not democracy, because we're also used to a democratic way of running things. Yes, we may vote on certain things, but what we're seeking to do is to discern the will and the mind of Christ according to Scripture on whatever decision it may be that's before us. Other things I could say on that, but I think I'm going to move on. And if you want to ask questions, we can discuss it shortly. That's the first principle, then, that of authority. The second principle that goes with independency and congregationalism is that of a regenerate church membership. A regenerate church membership. So independency, including Baptists, differ here from Presbyterianism and from Anglicanism. It's worked out in different ways in those two other systems. But the baptism of infants, as soon as you start baptizing infants, and coupled in the Church of England's case with the parish system, you've inevitably got a situation where the membership of the congregation is mixed. It's not a regenerate church membership in the sense in which we tend to mean that. In a Presbyterian or an Anglican situation, the congregation, the membership, if there is a membership system, will not all be converted. And that fact is fully accepted. That is understood. That is what is expected by those systems. Membership in a Presbyterian church in particular generally requires profession of a biblical understanding of the faith, an intellectual understanding of the faith, and an agreement with it, and the living of an outwardly moral life. But there isn't the attempt that I think we would generally want to see when we admit people into membership, an attempt to discern whether there has actually been regeneration that has taken place, a real conversion to Christ
in the heart and the soul. So a regenerate church membership is a mark of congregationalism, of independency. I'm using those two terms really interchangeably. Presbyterians and Anglicans sometimes accuse us then of searching after an unattainable goal, trying to peer into people's souls, which they say is impossible, trying to ascertain something that in this world we cannot know. But we do seek to do that, don't we? And we do admit that we make mistakes. You can see mistakes in the New Testament, can't you, in Acts chapter 8 with Simon. So we're not claiming that we're infallible on this, but what we do say is that we believe, as you look at the New Testament, you just believe it's surely as plain as anything could be, that the membership of the churches in the New Testament were in principle regenerate, that the members were born-again believers, so far as it was possible for anybody to discern that. Now, these two things are connected, aren't they? The way in which we run our church meetings, the involvement of the congregation in the decisions of the church, to whatever extent we permit that and encourage that, is part and parcel of the fact that we have a church membership that is in principle regenerate. If you don't have that principle of a regenerate church membership, you can understand why you would want to retain most of, if not all, the decision-making authority within the eldership, because you've got a mixed membership. But if, as we believe, we have a regenerate church membership principle, then that changes the nature of our understanding of the importance of the church meeting and the authority that it's able to exercise. So we've talked about authority, we've talked about a regenerate church membership. Thirdly, more briefly, separation from the state. Church of England, of course, is the established church in England. It's very much part of the state. The monarch is the supreme governor. The church's governing bodies govern by the authority of the state, and the formal legislative measures that the church adopts sometimes need the royal assent and approval by Parliament. They form part of the law of the land. There was a case recently in which church law came before the normal courts of the land, and the courts took jurisdiction of it without any difficulty. So a church in the Church of England is inevitably part of that system. It's part, really, of the state, or at least it's intertwined with the workings of the state. Presbyterianism is a little different. It is separate from the state. It's not run by the state. But nevertheless, Presbyterianism, although there is, I think, difference of views amongst Presbyterians, they tend to see a significant role, a more significant role than we would see for the civil authorities, the state authorities, in terms of generally upholding and maintaining the Christian religion in the nation. Independency tends to be less optimistic, I think rightly so, about the ability of state authorities, national or local, to play any significant role in the upholding of the Christian religion in the nation. It acknowledges, of course, the Christian duty to submit to earthly rulers, except where to do so would be to go against God's commands. So we have this principle of separation from the state. I must confess, and perhaps we can discuss this later, I get a little bit uneasy, a little bit uncomfortable sometimes when I see in the Christian media constant attempts to influence public policy, complaints about the state of the law, the way in which we're governed, and so on and so forth. I, on the one hand, sympathize with those things. Obviously, we are concerned about those things. But I wonder sometimes whether we spend too much time, too many resources in seeking to preserve a Christian feel to the nation and the way in which we're governed in our laws and policies. I feel a little bit divided about that, and perhaps, as I say, we can discuss it later. Separation from the state, and then fourthly, association. Really, after Andy's talk this morning, I don't think I need to say anything about this. I do have a real concern that in our independency, we have a great tendency to become isolationist. Now, we're all here as members, part of FIEC. By definition, I'm preaching to the converted. But I get concerned when I talk to friends in other church, well, in my own church, but talk to people about the subject of association or partnership or working together in some kind of structured, formal manner with other churches, that there's a great deal of hesitancy about that. And we tend, I think, to become isolationist. I know there's fear of too much bureaucracy, there's too much fear of control by outside bodies and so on. And that seems to feed into this isolationism, which I think we need to fight against. But Andy has covered that really so very well. I'm not sure I need to say very much more about it. You see in the New Testament constantly, the churches in the New Testament constantly interacting with one another, obviously before the days of email and easy travel and so on. They knew what was going on. They knew what was happening in other churches. They sent preachers and messengers between the churches. They swapped letters. They helped one another financially. They worked together. They saw themselves as responsible, having a level of responsibility one for another. They didn't just say, well, we'll get on with our work here and you get on with your work there and, you know, hopefully everything will work out. No, they felt a sense of responsibility one to another. So I very much want to emphasize when I talk on this subject that I'm advocating congregationalism, I'm advocating independency in the way that I've explained, but it ought to be associational. And by that I do mean some kind of structured association, not just informal relationships, but the more structured, even we could say formal relationships of the kind that we heard about this morning, which seemed to be an excellent example. At least those examples were two churches, and I would hope we can expand that. But some kind of structured formal relationship between churches associating and partnering together. Let me finish then just with some present challenges and then open up to questions and discussion. Four challenges that I think we need to think about in this context. One is that of pragmatism. I've mentioned this already. We can, I think, adopt an independent church government approach simply out of pragmatism because we don't like aspects of Anglicanism or Presbyterianism. And I'd encourage you to think through carefully, if you haven't already, I'm sure you have, but to think through carefully from the scriptures why it is that we believe positively that this is the way in which Christ intends his churches to be governed. And then to seek to explain that to your congregations. I'm going through that at the moment with our congregation in Bradford, even just to try to help people to understand. We've got quite a few new people who've been coming recently. They're not necessarily from the same church background. And trying to help them understand why we do the things we do the way we do them, why we meet the way we do, why we conduct church business the way we do, why we have a membership at all. Try to show them from the scriptures that these are matters of principle. This is how we believe Christ desires his church to be organized. So I think there's a need to teach these things as well as just practice them and to do so as a matter of principle, not just pragmatism. And then the second challenge, I think, is that of abuse. We can't ignore the dangers of abuse in its various manifestations, whether that's in the sexual field or whether it's in terms of abusive leadership or whatever it might be. There is no church order that can provide some kind of absolute safeguard or guarantee, of course, against abuse. But it does seem to me that if we ignore the biblical order, if we believe what I've been talking about to be the biblical order for local churches, if we ignore that, we should perhaps not be too surprised if we find that the balance between leadership and congregation, for example, is a little bit out of kilter. And the opportunity then for abusive leadership, or indeed the other way around, abuse of the leadership, comes in. Now, within a congregational system, within an independent system, there are dangers, of course. Bullying of a minister by the congregation, unsubstantiated allegations taken too seriously, so on and so forth. There's the danger of an eldership that takes too much responsibility on itself and doesn't allow the membership any role at all.
What's underlined, I think, is the importance of a biblical balance, again, as to the distribution of authority within the local church. Thirdly, withdrawal, what I mean by that is withdrawal from society, isolationism from society. I've talked about the dangers of isolationism as concerns other churches, but there's a danger, isn't there? I think particularly for us today of withdrawal from society. In fact, some people have been advocating this. Some evangelicals have been advocating this. The more and more, the more that society around us becomes alien from us in terms of what they believe and how they operate in so many aspects of life, there's the temptation to withdraw. And congregationalism that believes in a separation of church and state could exacerbate this danger. This is something I think we need to be careful about. And I think the answer is not simply to remain evangelistic, though of course that is necessary. But evangelism can be done, can't it, from a position of withdrawing from society, rather like, you know, shutting yourself up in a fortress and just making little sallies out to try to take pot shots at the enemy. That's, I think, not the way forward. The Bible makes very clear that we are to be part of the society to which we belong. God has put us here. We're to be as fully engaged in it as we can. And we need to encourage our members and ourselves to be salt and light within our societies, to live out ordinary daily lives just like everyone else, but with the difference that we live them for Christ in his strength. And I think a regenerate church membership, again, that principle that I talked about earlier, helps here, because we're talking to, we're dealing with people as we minister to them who we believe are born again of the Spirit of God and can be exhorted in this way. And finally, as I close, the dangers of fragmentation. Again, Andy dealt with this so well this morning. I don't really need to say very much. But there is a constant danger, isn't there? We're concerned for the truth. We're committed to the truth. We all have our ways of understanding what the Bible teaches on different aspects of the truth. But we need connections between churches. We need the association that I've been talking about, that kind of partnership. And so the FIEC, other forms of association, I'm very, very keen on regional associations because I think that's where a lot of really good work can be done. We need to keep our walls of separation low and shake hands over them often. Mark Dever quotes that a lot, but I discovered recently he got it from J.C. Ryle. J.C. Ryle says it before Dever. We need one another, all the more as our society becomes more openly antagonistic to the gospel. Associational congregationalism, then, I believe, is the biblical way, and I believe it's the way for the church to survive and flourish in Britain in the 21st century. I'll stop there. I put a bit of further reading, some reading on the handout. You may be familiar with David Scull's book. Well, a number of people wrote different chapters, Pure Church. It's on the bookstall. That, I think, would be a very, if you want a resource that would help members of your congregation to think through some of these issues, that would be a book worth considering to work through together, chapter by chapter. The other two books you may be familiar with, Mark Dever's book, The Church, The Gospel Made Visible, and I think a more recent book by him and Jonathan Lehman, Baptist Foundations, which is a bigger book. If you want a book that really expounds these principles in detail and gives you all the scriptural references and so on, that last one is the one to get. And I think those are both, they should both be available on the bookstall. I'll stop there. There's a roving microphone, so I'll open up for questions and discussion for a few moments. Anybody like to kick off? Yes. Adrian.
Am I allowed a question?
Yeah.
What historically has been the place, or what do you think is the place for multiple associations? So when you were describing the congregations coming together to think about matters of practice, you've clearly got to have a different height of wall, to extend that metaphor, from one than if you are planning a local mission, maybe.
Yep.
So it seems to me that there is a place for multiple associations. Yep. Is there any kind of place of that historically? How does that sort of fit into the historical pattern?
I think historically, probably not so much. So the Baptists would form their regional associations based on the 1689 confession normally. They'd have a national meeting, but again, that would be a 1689 type basis. I think informally, they would have good relationships locally. So the Baptist Church in Bradford-on-Avon would know the Congregationalists in Bradford-on-Avon, might meet together informally. But as far as I know, there's no formal way in which that was expressed. But I there's absolutely no reason why not, is there? And that's what I would seek to do where we are. We're working towards the formation of a regional 1689 confession Baptist association in the Southwest. But some of the churches involved in that are members of the FIEC. There's no problem with that at all. Nor would I see any difficulty with more local, broader evangelical structures meeting for prayer or for mission or whatever it might be. Yeah.
Thank you very much. One of the things yesterday I was struck by, John mentioned in his talk about how we might be losing freedoms when it comes to the conversion therapy law. Mm-hmm. Dan Strange mentioned certain professions perhaps becoming closed to members of our churches. And as you were going through the history, one of the things you said almost in passing was that these Baptist churches were meeting illegally for a long time. I was wondering, do you think there are any lessons we can learn from that period that might apply in the coming years?
Yeah, I think Dan or somebody mentioned also that right up until the 19th century, Baptists couldn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, couldn't be members of Parliament, I think. Was that right, John? Up until 19th centuries? Yeah. So, yes, we've had these disabilities. We've had these disabilities, but nevertheless flourished. You look at Spurgeon and what was going on under his ministry in London. And obviously, he never went to university. I think the lesson is just get on with it, isn't it, really? Not to mourn the fact that we can't do this, that, or the other, or we may be barred from this, that, or the other avenue of service within society, but just get on and do what we can do and do it in the strength of Christ and to his glory. I feel for the younger people in my congregation who are coming up, of course, like yours, in against precisely these issues. And you just wonder how long is it going to be sustainable for them to continue doing the kinds of work that they are doing, whether it's teaching or in the medical profession or even the legal profession. John, have you got any thoughts you want to add on this? You've thought about this a lot, I know.
I think that's exactly right. We are in the context in which we're in. It's worth remembering that tolerance, as it developed, I think, in our context, was as a result of the fact that the state, in the end, couldn't persuade people to submit to its law. That in the end, actually, tolerance wasn't won as a matter of principle. It was won out of the stubborn refusal of kind of nonconformists and others to conform.
Yes.
And people went to prison, people suffered disabilities, and in the end that shamed the state.
Yes.
And there's a point at which actually I suspect we will have to take some of those same stands and simply say to the state, no, we will not conform to this, and there will be a cost involved in that, and in the end that will have a shaming impact on a wider society that is kind of persecuting. And to some extent, I think the Brethren are also an interesting example here. So I think actually the Brethren voluntarily withdrew from things and separated themselves. But in some ways, what they did is what we're being forced to do. Mm. So again, you know, seeking trades rather than academic qualifications. I mean, there are all sorts of ways you can work. I mean, we have bought into a kind of a hierarchy of professionalism and an education, none of which are essential. They're just part of the respectability of society. Mm. And I think there's no doubt that the spiritual fervor of the gospel disappeared in the 1850s when basically nonconformists suddenly became respectable. Mm. And what they actually sought was respectability. You can see it in their degrees, in their buildings, in their structures. I mean, actually, there is a danger of respectability, and we're almost being forced to accept that we will not have a respectability that we have been used to.
I
think we'll just have to stick with those things. And it is about having gospel foundations and a willingness to suffer.
Yes. I think also we've, to some extent, that there's been a line of thinking, hasn't there, evangelistically, that sort of top down. You know, if we can capture the high points of society, the influential
aspects of society, if we can get good Christian men and women into those positions, that will have an effect, a sort of trickle-down effect on the rest of society. And no doubt there's truth in that. But what we're talking about now, I think, demonstrates that we can't put all our cards on in one hand, and we can't that's not going to work, is it, in a situation where those openings are not open to us. And Christ doesn't require those, does he? He's not dependent on our being influential in society in that kind of way. And we just have to get on with the work of preaching the gospel. Yeah.
Can you recommend in that light any good resources in church history for us to be reading, to share in illustration and example for the Lord's people?
Do you mean in terms of operating in a situation where we're under disabilities?
Yeah, I just think that'd be really helpful.
Yeah.
It's been a theme from yesterday, came from Dan.
Yes.
Somewhat from, and what John's shared there. I mean, John, sure. Have you read things on this?
I don't know that there is very much, to be honest.
I think the really big work, it's hugely expensive. So buy it and share it. And it's the three volumes of The Dissenters is really helpful, which is kind of history of the dissenting movement, really from the period Robert starts with right up until kind of early 20th century. Oxford University Press has also got a really interesting multi-volume series on history of nonconformity in Britain. Again, none of them are cheap. You know, we're talking 50 quid a volume sort of stuff. So they're hard to get hold of, and there are not many of them in libraries. But if we could find ways of which we could share those kinds of resources, there's some good work done there. John Coffey, who is professor of modern history at Leicester, has done quite a lot of work on the Puritans and on this nonconformist stuff. He's actually the editor of some of the volumes in the kind of Oxford history. That's really good stuff at kind of drawing out these challenges. So I think The Dissenters gives a really good picture of the kind of the history and what was suffered, how it changed, how tolerance came about. And I'd recommend that, I think, as good a starting place as any.
That's by Michael Watts. Are you familiar with archive.org? Volume 1 of Watts's work on The Dissenters is available. If you register, it's free. You can get the whole text on archive.org. Certainly Volume 1. I'm not sure about the other two volumes. But Volume 1 is the one that covers the period I'm talking about.
For a slightly less academic level, Nick Needham's 2000 Years of Christ's Power, Volume 4, covers the sort of Puritan period.
Right.
And the 18th century volume is coming out next year.
Great. So, we're waiting for Volume 5 to cover
2023 that. Years of Christ's Power. Yes, excellent. That's right. Yeah.
Michael Haken has also written on the early history of the Baptists in the 17th century, so there would be material in some of his books on this as well.
I was just fascinated listening to the English history, because I studied in Scotland. I got the similar trends happening differently in Presbyterianism in Scotland. Yep. But they had the same issues in terms of relationship with the state and the disruption in the 18th century, in the 19th century, the secessionists in the 18th century. So they're tackling that from a different perspective, in that evangelicals in Presbyterianism are really being persecuted.
Yeah.
And there's a real problem with their relationship with the state. So whichever strand you're in, it's still...
Yes.
The equivalents of, Robert Fitz in the 16th century in Scotland? I don't know. I mean, was John Knox doing such a good job that...
Scotland has always been a bit of a mystery to me, I must confess, Scottish history. I think the difficulty for a Presbyterian in this situation is that it's not what Presbyterianism would generally lead you to expect of the state of a Christian nation. The expectation is, once you have what would be regarded as a Christian nation, is that the magistrate would then support the church and uphold the truth. Yes, if they start persecuting you, which of course they do, and that's the lesson, isn't it, of English church history, then, yes, I think that leaves you with a real difficulty, theologically, intellectually.
Hi. Just a quick question on... thanks, it's been really helpful so far, thanks. Yes, I'm from Scotland, that's right. I'm hopefully not a mystery. On regenerate church membership, I was just wondering if you could just tease out a bit more, in a bit more detail. Mm-hmm. So beyond a credible profession and an obviously... Yeah. Godly life.
Yeah.
What are you, what, so just in a sense, what's the sort of structure or categories that you'd be looking for? Because you're saying you'd be looking for more than that.
No, that's what I would be looking for, a credible profession of faith. Okay. But it depends what you mean by credible.
Right, I suppose that's the argument. Yes, yeah. Fair enough.
So I think what we would generally be looking for, I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be evidence, biblical evidence, that this person is born again. So some change of life, some sense of sin, internal things, things to do with the heart. Those who come from a Presbyterian angle, my understanding is they wouldn't tend to do that, or not to the extent that we would. So they would want you to assent to the Christian faith, to the doctrines of the Christian faith. They would want to ensure that you were living a life that was at least outwardly in conformity with a godly lifestyle. But they wouldn't seek very hard to sort of look within as well and examine whether there's been a genuine experience of regeneration in the way that I think most of us would. Does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. At the back. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Phil, I didn't see you.
It might be quite relevant to the previous question, but another resource, if you wanted to look into it, is a book by a gentleman named Pascal Deneau. It's called The Distinctiveness of Baptist Covenant Theology. And he draws kind of comparisons between the Westminster Confession and the 1689 in the context of 17th century Presbyterian and Baptist kind of church membership polity. I found it really useful. It's one of the best books I've read this year. So
yeah,
take a look into it if you can.
It's quite a detailed theological account, isn't it?
But really
yes,
good.
If you're
really
up for that. Stuff. Pascal Deneau, Denault. Phil, what was the name of the book again?
The Distinctiveness of Baptist Covenantal Theology.
The Distinctiveness of Baptist Covenantal Theology. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Robert. Really appreciated this. One of the concerns often within independency is when there's an impasse in the life of the church, a dispute or something like that. I was fascinated what you said about the early associations of Baptist churches and the way in which they went about it. I know sometimes in independent churches today, there's a reluctance to involve a third party, which yep. often would seem fairly sensible.
Yeah.
Is there anything else from church history of independency that throws any light on this?
That's the main thing I'm aware of. And when I first came across it in the 1689 Confession of Faith towards the end, I was astounded, really, because it seemed initially to go against the idea of independency. I think they go as far as they possibly can without infringing technically on the independent authority of the local congregation. But it just seems to me to be very balanced and wise, whether it works out well in practice. As I said, the hymn singing controversy of the 18th century indicates it can't cope with everything, and I suppose that's what you'd expect. But it just seems to be very wise and balanced. So you maintain the principle of independency, very much so. You don't tell the churches what to do, but you have a system that enables things to be investigated and reported on, which inevitably exerts some pressure. I'm not aware, I can't think of other instances. I don't think the Congregationalists, the independents, did that. They didn't seem so keen on their associations and synods as the Baptists, actually. I think the Baptists are the ones to look at in terms of how these things worked out in practice in the 17th century.
So just a follow-up on that. Did the Baptists, so they would do these reports, it sort of seems in a sort of many ways to sort of mirror other sort of connectional sort of structures, obviously not infringing independency though.
Yeah.
Did they have a sort of red button of, right, we're disaffiliating you from our association? Or did they sort of not press that button? Obviously, nobody would press that with glee, but you'd be reticent. But did they have that avenue open to them?
In theory, yes. I'm not familiar enough with the detail to know whether it was ever actually exercised. But yes, if a church strayed so far from the confession of faith that it was could no longer be said realistically to be holding to that confession of faith, yes, in the end, you have to say goodbye, as would be the case, I suppose, with the FIC or any association. You've got to have that point. I'm not aware of any situation where that actually happened in the 17th century, it may have done.
Yeah. Like an informal soft power.
Yes. And again, even that I don't think was exercised very often. And as I said, with the hymn singing controversy, it didn't work. They did it, but it didn't work. But that became a very bitter dispute. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not aware that the FIC would operate it in that way. Would they, John? Try to help where there's a dispute between churches or within a church?
I mean, the FIC would want to provide help where churches invite us in to be able to deal with some of those kinds of issues. I think there's a certain clarity of things you have to agree to be within FIC. And if churches can no longer subscribe to those things or are actively rejecting them, there is the mechanism to remove them from fellowship. That's only happened once in the time that I've been here, because actually mainly churches, if they do disagree with those things, they voluntarily leave.
Mm.
I think the whole issue of abusive leadership has been a key area in which actually, again, what standards of behaviour are required. Because when we affiliate a church or accredit a minister, we are saying something publicly about our sort of acceptance of their way of behaving. And that's been an important area to think through, is what levels of behaviour put you beyond as being able to say, we to the world say that you're a church that we would recommend people go to. So there's a kind of an informal way of dealing with some of those matters. I think the key difference is you don't have the authority to tell the church what to do.
No.
At most, you can say you can no longer be part of our association,
yes,
but you are unable to step in and say, you must do this,
no,
you must remove that person, you must appoint this person as leader, etc. So it's much more relational,
yes,
rather than legal structured.
Sure. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, just on your comments about abuse, like two sides. What would you want a maturing congregation to understand about itself and its leaders? You can't avoid everything, but to avoid some of the things, heavy congregationalism, what would you want leadership to understand about the congregation and themselves to avoid heavy leading?
Yeah.
You can't avoid everything, but some things could be avoided.
Yeah.
What would you want to see in a maturing church and a maturing leadership?
Yeah, very good. So what I've been saying to my own congregation is, look, you can't just take a back seat and let the elders do everything and take all the decisions and all the responsibility. You, the membership, are involved. Christ has given his authority to the church as a whole, the congregation as a whole, to regulate and order the life of the church and to see it prosper. We're all in this together. You don't want the membership to be simply a rubber stamping exercise. But at the same time, I say to them, you see in the New Testament that the elders are there to lead. They are there even to rule. Some translations use that term, don't they, in 1 Timothy chapter 5. They're to govern, they're to shepherd, they're to teach. So it's that balance. You've got to emphasize both, I think. Otherwise, you end up with either an eldership that is overly dominant, which can become abusive, or a congregation that feels it's got to be involved and take a vote on everything, you know, the color of the carpets. And that's disastrous, isn't it? So I try to emphasize both and so avoid imbalance one way or the other. There's a question at the back. Hope that helps.
Hi, thanks for that. Really enjoyed it. It's a big question. I don't know whether, I'm just interested in what you think. Why did independency fail? You had a structured association, you had an emphasis on regenerate membership, but you end up with a liberal denominations at now FIAC.
Yes. Okay.
What lessons can we learn for the future from that?
Yes. I think that's a separate issue, why they declined theologically. Because what happened in the 18th century is the Presbyterianism declined and became Unitarian for the most part, abandoned the doctrine of the Trinity. Congregational churches, independent churches, actually for the most part remained more faithful doctrinally. And the Calvinistic Baptists also. So from that point of view, actually, I would say the record of independency congregationalism is better than that of Presbyterianism. Now, whether that's to do with their church order and government is a different matter. It may be partly to do with that. the argument that is that in a Presbyterian church, the power actually lies with the trustees of the building. They would be lay people and pastors would be coming in from academies that might have become liberal. The Presbyterian academies tended to become more liberal than the others. The reasons for all those things, to my mind, are still obscure, although people have tried to come up with answers. But actually, yes, the record of independency and congregationalism doctrinally is better. There was, yes, decline in the 19th century, I think for the reasons John has given. In volume three of Watts's book, The Dissenters, in his three-volume work, which is posthumous, he argues very, very strongly, I think successfully, that the dissenting desire or emphasis on education, on social work, and on political influence distracted them from the gospel. And that's why there was, he says, a decline, and I think there's a lot in that.
Robert, John, can I just make a comment? Yeah. I think the congregationalists, I think, became very much more like a denomination in the way that they functioned with all of their colleges and their structures.
Yes.
It seems to me that kind of where you have a denominational view, where you see the church as an institution that's a representation of the universal church, when there's false doctrine that comes in and it affects the whole institution.
Yes.
As that it takes the whole sort of context down. And it often comes through the colleges, through the leaders, then down into the churches. And lastly, it infects the congregations.
Yes.
And it's very, very difficult. It sounds as though an institution will protect sound teaching, but it often doesn't because it comes from the very people who are at the top of the institution. In independency, you lose individual churches and leaders, but actually independence then just create new churches. And in that sense, I think independency has been at the heart of preserving orthodoxy because people have walked away from corrupt institutions and have started new faithful gospel churches. And again, I think the Brethren are often underestimated as being hugely significant, particularly in the first half of the 20th century, as being the place where biblical orthodoxy was maintained. And then actually others have regrouped around that. So I think institutions get lost as a whole and it's very hard to win them back. Independency, you might lose individual churches and individual leaders, but often what happens is through a split or a new plant or whatever, you actually get new gospel life. And in that sense, I think independency has had a significantly better record of preserving biblical truth because basically gospel believers won't stay in institutions where that has been lost.
Yeah, I think that's very, very good. And my wife and I were on holiday in Orkney this summer, and up on one of the northern islands of the Orkney archipelago was a Brethren work from early in the 20th century. And they were really the only gospel work of any substance on the islands for a long time. I mean, really, wherever you go, in my experience, you find Brethren work. And more should be done on the history of the Brethren movement. I think we should probably draw this to a close. One last question, and then we'll just pray.
Yeah. Historically speaking, what did eldership plurality look like? So, was there a prominent pastor with elders alongside them? Was it a first among equals, or was it a more Brethren structure in eldership?
Yeah. So Congregationalists and Baptists for a long time would adopt the model of a pastor with deacons. If you had elders, that was the mark of Presbyterianism in the 18th century anyway. So the recovery of eldership in Baptist churches, at least, and I suppose Congregationalist churches as well, I'm a bit hazy on the history. I think that's the product of the mid-20th century, really, isn't it? Is that right, John, would you say? Yeah. So it was something that Baptist churches had to learn, I think. So you don't see, in the period I've been talking about, you don't really see pastors operating with elders on the whole. There are exceptions. Philip Doddridge, who I studied in some detail, was an exception. But yeah.